I should have shown you this next slide, which kind of summarizes that pro-monarchy, anti-monarchy division of those five passages. Early source, 9:1-10:16, 11:1-13, late source, 8:10-12. Notice the asterisk in 11:1-13 and 10:17-21. 11:1-13 is that story of Saul fighting the Ammonites in the aftermath of that going to Gilgal, who removed the kingdom and who makes Saul king. It's typical of mainstream biblical scholars to say that's one story about, or tradition about, how kingship arose in Israel. And that's combined then with 1 Samuel 10:17 to 27, kingship arose in Israel. That's the choosing of Saul by lot at the Israel. And those two conflicting accounts then are said to be harmonized by a redactional insertion in 11:14, where Samuel says, let's go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom. Renew the kingdom is the way we call it harmonized, instead of establishing to renew the kingdom. That's the term renew. But just those brief comments. There's more on that in your handout, but I think I'm not going to go into that in depth because of time, and I can move on to some other things. But let's go back to the handout. I do want to spend some time on 12, 14, and 15. We looked at 8. We're on page 4 of your handout. So let's look at 11, 14 to 12, 25. And first, let's look at 12:1-25. Samuel describes, or 1 Samuel 12 describes Samuel's challenge to Israel to renew her allegiance to Yahweh on the occasion of the introduction of kingship into the structure of the theocracy. Seems to me that's what goes on in 1 Samuel chapter 12. The chapter divides into the subsections that are listed here, first 1-5. Let's read these verses and then look at the comment. In 1-5, Samuel says to all Israel, I have listened to everything you said to me and have set a king over you. Now you have a king as your leader. As for me, I am old and gray. My sons are here with you. I have been your leader from my youth until this day. Here I stand, testify against me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I have done any of these, I will make it right. You have not cheated or oppressed us, they said. You have not taken anything from anyone's hand. Samuel said to them, the Lord is witness against you, and also his anointed is witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand. He is witness, they said. Now in those verses, I think what Samuel is doing is securing vindication of his own covenant faithfulness during the previous conduct of his office, as he presented the people with the one who was to assume the responsibilities of kingship. Samuel has been the religious and civil leader of the nation. He was the judge. But you notice what he says he hasn't done. He hasn't taken. That's certainly a reflection back to chapter 8. A king, like the nations round about, is someone who takes. I was not that kind of a leader. In 6-12, Samuel uses a resume of the righteous acts of Yahweh in the events of the Exodus and the period of the Judges in order to judicially establish Israel's apostasy in requesting the king. In other words, what he does is summarize the mighty acts of the Lord on Israel's behalf to show that Israel had no grounds for asking for a king. That's verses 6 to 12. Samuel said to the people, "It is Yahweh who appointed Moses and Aaron and brought your forefathers up out of Egypt. Now then, come stand here, because notice what I'm going to do. I'm going to confront you with evidence before the Lord as to all the righteous acts performed by the Lord for you and your father. After Jacob entered Egypt, they cried to the Lord for help. The Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your forefathers out of Egypt, settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God. He sold them into the hand of Sisera, commanding the army of Hazor, into the hands of the Philistines, king of Moab, who fought against them. They cried out to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned. We have forsaken the Lord, served the Baals and the Asherahs. Now deliver us from the hand of our enemies, and we will serve you.'" And what did the Lord do? The Lord sent deliverers. And he mentions some of the judges, bringing this up to date to the time of Samuel, who himself had been a deliverer. The Lord sent Jerubbaal, Barak, Jephthah, Samuel, and he delivered you from the hands of your enemies on every side so that you lived securely. But when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, was moving against you, you said to me, 'No, we want a king to rule us,' even though the Lord your God was your king." So you see what he's doing. He's showing the covenant faithfulness of the Lord to his people through previous generations and how they should have found their security in following after the Lord and being faithful to him, but they were not satisfied with that. So he establishes their apostasy in requesting the king. Verse 13 stands by itself. Samuel indicates that in spite of that apostasy, the Lord had chosen to use kingship as an instrument of Israel over his people. The time for kingship has arrived in God's sovereign purpose. So verse 13 says, "Now here is the king you have chosen, the one you asked for. See, Yahweh has set a king over you." It was the Lord's purpose to give them the food. I want to spend some time on verses 14 and 15. Let me read what I have here in your handout. Well, let me read the 14 and 15 in the NIV verse. NIV says, "If you fear the Lord and serve and obey him, and do not rebel against his commands, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow the Lord your God, good. But if you do not obey the Lord, and if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you as it was against your fathers." I think what you have here is a restatement of what you might call the covenant conditional. You notice this: if you do certain things, fear the Lord, obey him, don't rebel against his commands. A restatement of that on the occasion of integrating kingship into the theocracy. And that covenant conditional then takes on an added dimension, you might say. There's long been a consensus of interpreters that verse 14 has only a protasis, a grammatical subordinate clause expressing a condition. It only has a protasis and lacks an apotasis. The translation normally adopted is similar to the RSV and the NIV. Now, if you look on the screen, the King James, I think, translates this correctly. It translates it with an apotasis. Right in the middle of the verse, you get that bend. You see, King James says, "If you fear the Lord and serve and obey him, do not rebel against his commands, then shall both you and the king who reigneth over you continue following the Lord your God." But if you look at the NIV and the RSV says, "If you fear the Lord and obey him and serve him, don't rebel against him. And if both you and the king who reigns over you continue following the Lord your God, it supplies it will be well." That's not in the Hebrew text. It adds it. In other words, it only has a apodosis. It's only that if that goes all the way down through the whole verse. There is no apodosis. The apodosis is provided by it working well in the RSV. That's basically what the NIV does. If you fear the Lord and serve and obey, do not rebel against his commands, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow the Lord your God, NIV says good. Good's not in the Hebrew text. That's provided. Now, go back to your handout, top page 5, where I have the RSV as is on the screen. But notice the comment, second paragraph, page 5. The last phrase, it will be well in the RSV, or good in the NIV, does not occur in the Masoretic text and must be added to complete the sentence. As H.P. Smith has pointed out, and this is the logic for translating the verse this way, in spite of it's not being worded that way in Hebrew. Smith points out, quote, to begin the apodosis with lahiyatem, normally translated then, in the middle of the verse, like King James does, is grammatically the correct thing to do. That's the way the Hebrew reads. But Smith feels that to translate it that way produces a redundancy because, quote, it makes an identical proposition. If you fear Yahweh and obey him, do not rebel against his commands, then you will follow Yahweh. You see, he's saying that makes no sense. It's a redundancy. So, the tradition has been, by a number of translations and many commentators, to just continue that conditional all the way through the verse and to supply an apodosis, which isn't in the original text. Now, it seems to me, if you compare verse 14 with verse 15, which is really the same statement, but in negative terms, rather than positive terms, it's clear that structurally, the verse divides in the middle. And there is a prodesis and an apodesis. You see, 15 reads in the NIV, but if you do not obey the Lord, if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you as it was against your father. It should read, then his hand will be against you. Except for he then, just like it is in 14. King James has the right. If you will not obey, then. RSV, if you will not hearken, then. NIV, but if you do not obey, doesn't put the then in, but it's implied, although it's in the Hebrew text, his hand will be against you. So it seems to me, you look at 15, you see the structure of 15, it's the same as 14. Both verses should be translated the same way. Well, now, what difference does that make? What's the significance of what's going on? I think, go back to your handout. Smith's objection to translating the verse 14 the way the King James does, with the then apodosis in the middle of the verse, Smith's objection turns on his understanding of the expression, "Vahiyatem acher Adonai." Then you will follow Yahweh. That last line in the verse. Then shall both you and the king who reigneth over you continue following the Lord your God. He says that's a redundancy, saying the same thing in the first part of the verse. However, that expression occurs in several other places in the Old Testament. I've listed several. 2 Samuel 2:10, 15:13, 1 Kings 12:20, and 16:21. I want to look at them because in all of those places, you will see that that expression is used to indicate that the people of Israel or a segment of the people have chosen to follow a particular king in a situation where there was another possible alternative. Look at 2 Samuel 2:10. 2 Samuel 2:10, Ishbosheth, son of Saul, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel. He reigned 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. That, in the Hebrew, is that expression, Asher Darud. The house of Judah was after David. In other words, what you have is the decision of Judah to follow David while Ishbosheth reigned over the remainder of the nation. There was an alternative. There were divided loyalties between the people, between Ishbosheth and David. And Judah was after David. 1 Kings 12:20. When all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to an assembly, made him king over Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained after the house of David. Now he says, loyal to the house of David. This is the time of the division of the kingdom. Jeroboam's reigning in the north. Only Judah is following David, is after David. Judah followed the house of David at the time of the division of the kingdom. 1 Kings 16:21. Then the people of Israel were split into two factions. Half supported Tibni, son of Ginath, for king, and the other half supported Omri. Now, that supported is this same expression. Half were after Tibni, son of Ginath. The other half were after Omri. Divided loyalties between Tibni and Omri after the death of Zimri. In 2 Samuel 15:13, the rebellion of Absalom, I won't look at that just for time, but the men of Israel chose to give allegiance to Absalom and recognize him as king instead of David. They are after Absalom. Now, looking at use of that expression, same expression as in 12:14 in the middle of the verse. Using this understanding of the phrase, then one can say that here at Gilgal, Israel entered a new era in which the old covenant conditional took on a new dimension. Now, what do I mean by that? With the institution of kingship, the potential is created for the people to have divided loyalties between Yahweh and the human kingdom. Because of this, Samuel challenged the people to renew their determination to obey Yahweh, not to rebel against his commands, and thereby, that's what the apostasis is addressing, to demonstrate that they continue to recognize Yahweh as their sovereign. It is then not necessary to conclude that the expression, if you fear Yahweh, then you will follow Yahweh, is a redundancy or an identical proposition. Rather, this is the expression of the basic covenant conditional in terms of the new era Israel was entering. If Israel fears, Yahweh obeys him, doesn't rebel against him, what will she do? She will show that she continues to recognize Yahweh as her sovereign, even though human kingship has been introduced into the structure of the theocracy. Israel must not replace her loyalty to Yahweh with loyalty to her human ruler. That's the issue being addressed. And that's the issue that these translations, with the exception of King James, obscure. I was part of the team that worked on the New Living Translation version. I put the way that is worded in the New Living there. Now, if you fear and worship the Lord and listen to his voice, and if you do not rebel against the Lord's command, then both you and your king will show you recognize the Lord as your God. And that's in the context of this potentiality we see of divided loyalty. Seems to me that's an issue. All right, 16 to 21. A sign given from heaven at Samuel's request to demonstrate the seriousness of Israel's apostasy in asking for a king to replace Yahweh. Samuel says in 16, "See this great thing the Lord is about to do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest? I will call upon the Lord to send thunder and rain. You will realize what an evil thing you did in the eyes of the Lord when you asked for a king. And the Lord sent the thunder and the rain. And the people asked for Samuel to intercede for them, and he does." So it was a serious sin to ask for a king to replace Yahweh. And it displayed contempt for previous deliverances, the lack of confidence in Yahweh's government. In 12:23-25, over on page 7, Samuel describes his own continuing function in the new order. Notice what he says in 23. "As for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you. And I will teach you the way that is good and right." Chapter 12 is often called Samuel's farewell address. In fact, NIV has that written. This is not a farewell address. Samuel isn't going anywhere very soon. He's no longer going to be their civil leader. There's a king who is coming. But he's going to pray for the people. And he's going to instruct them. He's going to perform the role of the prophet. And he says, "I will teach you the way that is good and right." What's the way that is good and right? It's the way of the covenant. And he does that. Of course, he calls Saul to account. And eventually rejects Saul. And wants to... So Samuel describes his own continuing function in the new order, concludes his remarks by a repetition of Israel's central covenantal obligation, verse 24, reinforced by the threat of the covenant curse of Israel during the apostasy. I think 24 pretty well sums up the essence of Israel's covenant obligation. It's a great verse. Notice what it says. "Be sure to fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart." That's that fundamental obligation of covenant loyalty. And what motivates that? Consider what great things he has done to you. See, that's a historical prologue again. The beneficent, gracious acts of the great king on behalf of his people. That demands the obligation of God's loyalty. But that is qualified in verse 25. "If you persist in doing evil, both you and your king will be slain." The threat of the covenant curse. Now, I'm going to stop with that. What follows on page 7 is a rather detailed discussion of 11, 14, and 15. I'm going to skip over that. But I think that what you have in this section that we looked at, from 8 through 12, is Israel's sin in requesting a king, the Lord's determination, the time for kingship has arrived, his instruction to Samuel to give them a king, and then that is carried out with the inauguration of Saul's reign in the context of a renewal of allegiance to the Lord in an assembly called Ethiopia. Israel renews their allegiance to the Lord on the occasion of the inauguration of Saul's king. If you look at 11, 14, and 15, I'll just read that and make a couple brief comments. I think 11 and 14 and 15 summarize all that goes on in chapter 12. You read in 11, 14, and 15, after Samuel's victory over the Ammonites, he says to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal," and there, NIV says, reaffirm the kingship. I think it's a bad translation. It should say, renew the peace. Hadash is the word. It doesn't mean reaffirm. It means renew. The question is, renew whose kingdom? And I think in context, it's the kingdom of Yahweh. This is the renewal of allegiance to Yahweh. Let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom. So all the people went to Gilgal, and NIV says, confirm Saul as king in the presence of the Lord. It doesn't say confirm Saul as king. It says they made Saul king. It's Yom Kippur. It's the word that's the Hebrew form to make a king. They made Saul king. So they went to Gilgal to renew the kingdom, Yahweh's kingdom, and there they made Saul king. It's not a renewal of Saul's kingdom in verse 14, because Saul had not yet been inaugurated as king. This is his inauguration of his reign. So they went to Gilgal and made Saul king in the presence of the Lord. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings before the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. Now there are two rather crucial translation issues in that. I just touched on it. There's more detail on that in the handout. I'm not going to hold you accountable for that in your exam, but if you want to read through that handout, you'll see some more detail on what the issues are. Any questions on that? But they went to Gilgal, renewed the kingdom, made Saul king, they sacrificed fellowship offerings before the Lord, Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. That's what went on in Gilgal, and the details of that are described in chapter 4. All right, if you go back to your outline. Number 6 is Samuel rejects Saul. Chapters 13 and 15. In chapter 13, the Philistines again are assembled to fight Israel. And you read in verse 7, the Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. Now that reference to 7 days, time set by Samuel, is a reference back to chapter 10, verse 8. At the time that Samuel had anointed Saul, he told him, you see in 10:8, go down ahead of me to Gilgal. I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you are to do. So this is the situation. Saul goes to Gilgal. He's waited there 7 days. Samuel still hasn't come. So in verse 9, Saul says, bring me the burnt offering and fellowship offering. And Saul offered up the burnt offering. And just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived. So he didn't wait long enough. He's still on that seventh day. What have you done? Asked Samuel. Saul replied, when I saw men were scattering, and you did not come at the set time, and the Philistines were assembling, I thought, the Philistines will come down against me, and I have not sought the Lord's favor, so I felt compelled to offer the offering. And Samuel's response is, you acted foolishly. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people. So because Saul did not obey the word of the prophet Samuel, as he had been instructed, the Lord tells him that he will not have an enduring dynasty. At this point, he is not going to be removed from his office as king, but he will not have an enduring dynasty of Russia.
Since his inauguration,
it's hard to say. But it doesn't seem like a very good event. Chapter 15 is another chapter where Saul receives an instruction from the Lord through Samuel. You read in the first verse, Samuel said to Saul, "I'm the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people." So listen to the message from the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty says. So here's a word of the Lord. "I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up out of Egypt." Remember, we looked at that. They were on their way to Sinai, and the Amalekites attacked. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Write this down. Going to remember this." And now he instructs Saul, "Attack the Amalekites, totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them, put to death men, women, children, infants, cattle, sheep, cattle." This is Karam again, just like you have in the book of Joshua. Well, Saul attacks the Amalekites. Like you read in verse 8, he took Agag alive, and verse 9, spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the cattle and the fat calves and everything that was good. And the Lord comes and tells Samuel, "I'm grieved I've made Saul king," verse 11, "because he's turned away from me and has not carried out my instruction. Literally, he has not obeyed my words." That "turned away from me" is that same expression you had in 11:14. To be after the Lord, he was not after the Lord. So, the Lord sends Samuel to confront Saul. And when Samuel reaches him, notice what Saul says, verse 13. Saul said, "The Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's instructions." Samuel isn't taken in. He says, "What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears? What is this lowing of cattle?" And then Saul justifies himself. "The soldiers brought them." Tries to shift responsibility. "They spared the best of the sheep and the cattle to sacrifice to the Lord." Use the pronoun, "your God." Doesn't say "my God." "But we totally destroyed the rest." Samuel does not accept that. Verse 19, "Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?" "But I did obey the Lord," said Saul. Tries to justify himself. And I think, you know, here's the difference between Saul and David. David did some bad things, but every time he was confronted by a prophet, he made no excuses, did not charge a shift on him. He accepted responsibility and repented. And Saul didn't do that. And he says in verse 20, "I did obey the Lord. I went on the mission the Lord assigned. I completely destroyed the Amalekites, brought back Agag to their king. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God again, the Gilgal." It's as if going through these rituals and somehow justifies disobedience. And Samuel's reply there is a classic statement on the relationship of sacrifice to obedience. He says, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice. To eat is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination and arrogance like the evil of idolatry, because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he's rejected you as king." You go back to that covenant conditional in 14, "You obey the Lord, follow him, do not rebel." Here, Saul did rebel and tries to justify it. And because of that, the Lord says, I have rejected you. And in the very next chapter, 16, Samuel 10, to anoint Saul's replacement, which is good. The rest of the first Samuel describes the downward spiral of Saul and the rise of David, you might say, to the book. So, at the end of the book, Saul dies, taking his own life in the battle of the Philistines, the last chapter of 1 Samuel. And getting to 2 Samuel, David assumes the throne in his place. I'm going to stop our discussion of Samuel with those comments. I want to go on to Romans 7 on your outline. We'll skip 6. But Romans 7, the divided kingdom, and A is 1 Samuel Kings, and B is 1 Samuel Chronicles. I want to just to close our discussions, say a few things about Kings and Chronicles under this heading, the divided kingdom. David, of course, reigns all the way through 2 Samuel. It's in 1 Kings 1 and 2 that you get the transition to the reign of Solomon. And you have the reign of Solomon up through 1 Kings 11. But with 1 Kings 12, you get the divided kingdom. And then you get Rehoboam in the south, Jeroboam in the north, Rehoboam in the line of David, Jeroboam not of the line of David. So that's the divided kingdom here. A is 1 Samuel Kings, 1 is name and scope of conduct. Remember when we talked about the name of Samuel, I mentioned that it was originally one book, had subsequently been divided at the time of death of Saul. Tradition tells us the book of Kings was originally one book as well. And the Septuagint split both Samuel and Kings into two books and called them of the kingdoms, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the Vulgate modified that to Kings, 1, 2, 3, and 4. I mentioned that with our discussion of Samuel. I think I mentioned you'll sometimes come across commentaries with that nomenclature, Kings 1, 2, 3, and 4. We know the book says 1st, 2nd Kings, and 4th Samuel is 1st, 2nd Samuel. So 1st, 2nd Kings would be Kings 3 and 4 in the Vulgate tradition. But as I mentioned a minute ago, the book begins with the transition from the rule of David to Solomon. It ends with the accounts of the last kings of Judah, Jehoiachin and Zedekiah, both of whom were taken captive to battle. They begin with the last year of the reign of David, and show how Israel divided at the end of Solomon's reign and then eventually fell to Assyrian battle, to Assyria in the northern kingdom, to Babylon in the southern kingdom. So the book covers a period of about 400 years, about 970 to 586. Approximately 400 years. As far as dates, 931 is an important date. Does anybody know what that is? That's the division of the kingdom. Transition to divided kingdom after the reign of Solomon. But 931 721 and 586 are the three key dates. 721 is the fall of the northern kingdom to the Assyrians. 586 is the fall of the southern kingdom, Judah, to the Babylonians. So that gives you kind of a chronological structure. The author is unknown. Seems like someone who was a contemporary of Jeremiah, who had access to records of the reigns of earlier kings. But we don't know who the writer was. Number two on your outline is purpose of kings. Look at your citations, page 56. I have a paragraph there from Gleason Archer on 1 Kings, where he says, the theme of these two books was to demonstrate on the basis of Israel's history that the welfare of the nation ultimately depended upon the sincerity of its faithfulness to the covenant with Jehovah, and that the success of any ruler was to be measured by the degree of his adherence to the Mosaic Constitution and his maintenance of a pure and God-honoring testimony before the people. The purpose of this record was to set forth those events which were important from the standpoint of God and his program of redemption. The author had no intention of glorifying Israel's heroes out of nationalistic motives. Hence he omitted even those passing achievements which were to have assumed great importance in the eyes of a secular historian. His prime concern was to show how each successive ruler dealt with God in his covenant responsibilities. And remember, I said, I think the overall theme of 1 Samuel was covenant kingship. That theme follows on through 1 Kings. These kings are assessed on the basis of their covenant faithfulness. And it's that perspective that really runs from Joshua through Judges, Samuel, and Kings. It's that Deuteronomic perspective. Because of the importance of that covenantal perspective, the role of the prophets in relation to various kings receives a great deal of emphasis. The kings who are treated most thoroughly are those kings in whose history the prophets had an important function. And that's true whether the relationship is hostile or more favorable. For example, in Jeroboam the first, Ahijah the prophet confronts him. With Ahab, a king who led the northern kingdom astray, you remember who the prophet was? Elijah. And there are a number of chapters given to the reign of Ahab because of the prominence of Elijah. With more favorable relationship to a king, you think of Hezekiah, where Isaiah had a strong input into his life and reign. Remember that the relationship between kings and prophets was really established by Samuel. Samuel was a prophet, and Samuel was God's instrument in establishing kingship. And we looked at that text where Samuel said, I'm going to teach you the good and the right way. That's what prophets did to kings as well as to the people. And in Israel, the king was always accountable to the prophet. So the result is, you have in 1-2 Kings a description of this period of time in which the kings are judged by the measure of their faithfulness to their covenant obligation. I think I mentioned way back at the beginning of the course, you see this perspective in someone like Omri and his son Ahab. Omri was a very significant king. Israel's called the land of Omri, centuries after the time of Omri. He was the one that founded Samaria as the capital of northern Israel. He had a dynasty that went down to several generations. He's treated in 1 Kings 16, 23 to 28. He's given six verses. And very little is said about it. But his son Ahab receives a great deal of attention because Ahab is the one who led Israel astray to worship Baal and Ashtoreth rather than following the Lord. And it's during the time of Ahab that Elijah is raised up as a prophet. You get all those stories of the interaction of Elijah with Ahab and Ahab's sons. If you look at the assessment of the kings, you will find unqualified approval only of two, and that's Hezekiah and Josiah. Hezekiah in 2 Kings 18:37, Josiah 2 Kings 22:2. Qualified approval of a number where they walked in the way of their father David, but, and then you get the qualified, didn't remove the high places or something of that sort. The strongest disapproval is of Ahab in the north and Manasseh in the south. So you get that kind of assessment of the kings with the highest degree of unfaithfulness in Ahab and Manasseh, and the highest degree of faithfulness in Hezekiah and Joseph. I think the end result of the book is to show God's justice in bringing about the fall of both the northern and the southern kingdom. And you find that described quite well in 2 Kings 17. I'd like to turn that there with you. You read in verse 5 of 2 Kings 17, King of Assyria invaded the land, marched against Samaria, lay siege to it. In the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Assyria, captured Samaria, deported the Israelites to Assyria. So there is the exile of the northern kingdom. Now notice what follows. You get an explanation for why this happened. All this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, worshipped other gods, followed the practices of the nation. Verse 9, Israelites secretly did things against the Lord their God that were not right. Verse 10, they set up sacred stones, the Asherah poles. Verse 12, they worshipped idols. So the Lord had said, you shall not do this. Verse 13, the Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and seers, turn from your evil ways, observe my commands. Verse 14, but they would not listen, and were stiff-necked as their fathers, who did not trust in the Lord their God. And verse 15 sums it up. Why the exile? They rejected his decrees and the covenant he made with their fathers and the warnings he had given them. They followed worthless idols and made themselves worthless. They imitated the nations around them. That's the essence. That's the reason for the exit. So what happened? You read verse 18. So the Lord was angry with Israel and removed them from his presence. Now, what about Judah? You see, that's 7.1.
That's out of the northern kingdom, fall of Samaria.
Judah doesn't go into exile until sometime later under the Babylonians, when power in Mesopotamia had switched from the Assyrians to the Babylonians. But it was the very same issue. And chapter 17 goes on. Notice what it says. Only Judah was left. And even Judah did not keep the commands of the Lord their God. They followed the practices Israel had introduced. Therefore, the Lord rejected all the people of Israel. He afflicted them and gave them into the hands of plunderers, and he thrust them from his presence. So, that is the explanation of why Israel went into captivity. As far as structure of the book, I think this will help give you some handle on the content of the book. It's, you know, it's the, when you get to the divided kingdom period, it's the synchronous reigns of the kings of the north and the south. It's kind of hard to structure. But this gives you a broad structure. First 11 chapters are Solomon's reign, the United Kingdom under Solomon. And then from 1 Kings 12, where you have the divided kingdom, Rehoboam in the south, Jeroboam in the north. If you go from 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17, the chapter we just looked at, that's the divided kingdom until the fall of Samaria, 7.1. And then what follows in 18 to 25 is the continuation of Judah after Israel's fall until the fall of Judah, the end of the book. So that gives you a general structure of the content of 1 17. Now, we've got just a few minutes left. Let's go on to 1 2 Chronicles. Let me make just a few comments here. I think a question that often arises is, what's the difference between 1 2 Kings and 1 2 Chronicles? Why do you have these two books that have a fair amount of overlap as far as content? I think the basic difference is Kings is retrospective. It's addressed to the needs of the community in exile. And it explains to those people the reason for their condition, the reason why they are in exile. Chronicles is more prospective. Chronicles addresses the needs of the restored community that has come back from exile. And what it emphasizes is those things that would provide a basis for those who had returned from exile to begin the process of reconstruction on a firm basis after return from exile. Now, with that general idea in mind, what are the emphases of Chronicles that provide this basis for those returning from exile to build for the future? The first major emphasis is on the kingship of David and his successors in Judah. That becomes a focal point, and that's clear right from the beginning of 1 Chronicles, where you have genealogical material, and the first tribe that is traced is that of Judah. And within the tribe of Judah, the house of David is emphasized with the entirety of chapter 3 tracing the generations of David. So the focus becomes on David, and comparatively little attention to the other tribes. And I think what the author is doing is emphasizing that hope for the promised Messiah that had been talked about by the previous prophets is to be sustained in the line of David, as was promised in the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7, but as repeated in 1 Chronicles 17. So the focus is on David and his line for the future. And for that reason, there's very little mention of the kings of the north. It's only the kings of the line of David. Kings of the north are only mentioned in connections with situations in which they're involved in something that happens in the south. There's no reference even to the fall of the northern kingdom. And the line of David, even though it's given extensive treatment, it doesn't describe the family affairs of David, the Bathsheba incident, and all the aftermath of that, with all the misery that came into David's life and family as a result of it. David's pictured as an example of the true theocratic king, pointing forward to the messianic king who was to come. So you have that emphasis on David and his house, and you have emphasis on the temple and its service as a legacy that was left to the restored community by the house of David. The rebuilt temple and its continuing service are to be seen as evidence that God is not finished with his people. There's still a future for the people of God. And then a third emphasis for the restored community is the importance of obedience to the law and the prophets. And that is emphasized by calling attention to the theme of divine retribution. And what I mean by that, as the chronicler describes the reigns of the various kings, he emphasizes that sin brings judgment, while obedience brings blessing and prosperity. And that concept is exhibited in the reigns of the kings of Judah is to be a foundation on which the nation is to build after return from Isaiah. So, kings more retrospective, to explain to a people in exile why they are there. Chronicles more prospective, to lay the foundations for a restored community from ourselves to build for the future.